Happy Mother's Day, everybody.
I choked on my own words there.
This is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema.
I'm having a throat situation. That's what's going on.
You've been doing that Tuvan throat singing. It wears you out.
I've been doing a lot of Tuvan throat singing. And it's, you know, it's pretty demanding.
Yes.
Training.
It's a harsh mistress.
I joined the Gyuto monks, really, is what I did. And so, you know, they've got me in training. Actually, the jacaranda are blooming.
Yes.
And in addition to that being a situation where everyone's car on the street
is covered in plant love juice,
purple ejaculate from the trees, it's allergy time.
Mm-hmm.
So I woke up this morning with...
That's why the Flonase ad is on all the time.
I woke up this morning with a weird...
Throaty.
Like a giant rock in my throat.
Oh.
I know it doesn't make any difference to how I talk.
Good point.
I sound the same with allergies as other people sound with allergies. I sound that way without allergies.
Brenda Vaccaro after three packs of cigarettes.
But I am... Yeah. I have a gigantic cup of hot lemony water.
Yes.
In my hand right now.
It's a coffee cup that you bought me, which I really appreciate it because
it's gigantic.
Imagine the lower half of a barrel with a handle on it.
it's quite large. All these years you've been like, could you find me a mug that's really big? And I'd bring one home that was kind of big and you'd be like, no, I mean big. So this one, it's
almost cartoon big.
It may be like 3 or 4 cups worth of liquid holdability.
It's the kind of thing where like daytime drag queens would hold it to make their hands look small.
There's like a liter capacity to this mug.
Well, we had that great Sundance mug from this year.
You
that
may
I,
hear
that,
me sipping while the show's on because I have to keep myself
lubricated,
juicy on the inside.
We had this Sundance had these great mugs this year that were nice and hefty sized, and of course we don't have a dishwasher. And at one point, while scrubbing it myself, I had done dropped it, and that was that. So
you can order another one online.
I know,
we can do that.
Okay,
and it'll make you happy.
I would like another one.
I like making you happy.
No, oh.
It's look, it goes a lot easier for me when you are.
It's my birthday month, so...
Month?
Let the celebrations begin. Oh, please, like, you're not the one who pioneered the whole, like, the month of me. I learned it from you, Dad. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film reviews editor for The Wrap and film critic and TV recapper for What the Flick. And you are Dave White.
Yes.
Of this show and this website, linoleum-knife.com.
Yes. I'm also with The Wrap now.
You are with The Wrap now. And you are...
It started as a mistake.
Yes.
As a fill-in deal.
It was a desperation move.
But I'm just so damn good. that the editor... had to see past the fact that I'm his husband and admit my copy's clean.
It is.
I don't need much editing.
Not much.
Some commas here and there. And, you know.
And you're my official Jesus movie correspondent now.
Yeah. I'm the person who writes about Jesus movies. There's another one coming out this coming week.
Yes.
Last Days in the Desert.
Yes, we'll talk about that next week.
Ewan McGregor plays Jesus and the devil. So that's not going to sit well with a lot of folks. But whatever.
Look, you know, the thing that people always seem to miss, well, A, they always miss that every time an angel appears in the Bible, the first thing they say is, don't be afraid.
Right.
But we have somehow turned them into these, like, little sexless cherubs. And the devil, as Albert Brooks so hopefully points out in broadcast news, is not going to show up with this, as this awful horned thing. He's going to be attractive.
You look like Ewan McGregor.
You look like Ewan McGregor.
We have one giant superhero movie to talk about.
We do.
We'll talk about that closer to the end.
Okay.
Because
people should know about the non-superhero movies coming this week.
Oh, by the way.
And the garbage truck that apparently is backing up outside.
I made a decision.
Did you?
Yeah. You know, okay, first of all, you know, we've got the subscription.
Yes.
And if people want to subscribe for items and extra content, they can go do that at Patreon/linoleumknife.
Right, all one word.
But in addition to the subscription, occasionally we have advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
Not very often, but sometimes.
Every so often.
Some people pop out and, oh, like, I was a teenage were-skunk.
For instance.
And I missed their screening.
Oh, no.
I had a different screening.
Though. Oh, that's right. Yeah. You did, yeah. We hope that went well.
I hope that I have another chance to see it.
If listeners, if any of you went, drop us a line. Tell us how it went. linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
But
congratulations to the were-skunk team for getting it finished and getting it shown.
But here was my decision. There are going to be plenty of weeks where we just don't have an advertiser.
Right.
Listen, if you're an advertiser and you want to advertise on a podcast with a small but loyal listenership, we're in the market for that.
Sure.
But until that happens, I believe that Linoleum Knife should always be brought to you by Exile in Guyville, the audiobook.
Oh, well, sure.
Sometimes people, when they subscribe, depending on at what level they subscribe, they get Exile in Guyville, the audiobook, for free.
Yes, they do.
As a gift, a prize.
A bonus.
A club membership prize.
A perk.
A burden to their ears. But the rest of you, maybe you have not yet experienced that particular burden to your ears, and maybe you think you're ready for it.
You may purchase it a la carte.
Yeah. Exile in Guyville. Wait, no.
Yes.
That's the name of the book.
Exile in Guyville book.tumblr.com.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
Exile in Guyville book.tumblr.com. You go to that, and it'll show you how to get it. Guess what? It's super cheap. For example, it is $1.
Or
any other amount of dollars that you want. Maybe you don't even know what Exile in Guyville is.
It could also be $5,000.
It was the memoir. It was the memoir I wrote that got published in 2006.
Right.
I got an actual book deal.
It's true.
By an actual publisher. Hilarious.
Yes.
Then they went belly up few years back.
And we're passing the savings along to you.
Yeah. So now that book is way out of print. And I've been told that copies go for weird amounts of money on the internet, which is
really
strange to me. You'd think you could get it for a penny.
Well, you know, the thing is, I always wonder, like, why I'm not remaindered, you know, and it's because none of our books have been published in such mass quantities
right.
that they would then get remaindered.
Right.
So.
Anyway, I decided to...
We're cult failures, as the movie Garp would say.
Yeah. I decided to record the audio version. 10 hours of me. Is it 6 or 10?
I don't remember.
It's several hours.
It's lengthy.
Several hours of me reading this entire book from start to finish with an additional postscript. That is not in the book.
Yes.
And music by the incredible Los Angeles doom, death, black metal band, Harasser.
who currently pop up on the soundtrack for Green Room,
which we're about to talk about right now. Go to exileandguyreelbook.tumblr.com. Spend any amount of money that you like, and you can have Exile and Guyreel, the audiobook, read by me. Written by me.
Before we segue...
About me.
Before we segue into... And I'm in it, too. Before we segue...
Sure.
Before we segue into Green Room, I just wanted to remind folks that also, if you are not a Patreon subscriber or not a Patreon subscriber at a certain level, you can also separately buy our Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes.
Oh, is that up now?
It is now
up. It's up. It's finally up and done and ready.
We have just done
We're well over a week late.
A little bit over a week late. We are, but just in time for Mother's Day, it's the Dardenne Brothers 2 Days, 1 Night, starring Marion Cotillard as a working mom.
As a working mom.
Trying to save her job. It's a great movie. It is the first foreign film that we've done a commentary track for, the most recent film we've done a commentary track for. But I think it came out really well. And if you should obviously see the movie first, because it's great, but then we'll talk about, you know, the Dardenne brothers' career and Marion Cotillard's career, and I share my favorite French tongue twister, and there's a lot of great stuff.
This episode, this extra Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, is my favorite one so far.
Really?
Yes. Because I felt so much more organized than before. The conversation that we had for 90 minutes over the running time of that film, I think it had a direction and a purpose. And I felt like we had got a lot of information in.
Yeah, although I still like it when we freeform.
What I'm trying to say is I kind of wrote a script. Not a script, but...
an outline.
A very firm, firmly paced outline. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't a script, because...
No.
We'd ruin that, no. But you know what I mean.
Yeah. You.
I was organized.
There was some structure in there.
I took over.
You did. I let you have this one. I have an idea for the next one. I'll tell you about it off mic.
I thought we'd already picked our movie for the next one.
Okay, then maybe the one after that.
We'd already picked our movie for the one after that, too.
Oh, my God. All right, well, I have one to go into the hopper.
Tell me. Just tell me right now. What do you think? What do you want to do?
I think it would be fun if we did the first Avengers movie.
Gulp.
I think we might have
to... Why do you want to do that?
Because I think that we need to balance out with films that people... know and are interested in, and I think I would have. I think I have
people.
Oh, them.
Yeah.
I think I would have some interesting things to say about that, and I would help you through it because I know you're not as much of a comic book person as I am.
Okay. You know what? Sure.
Somewhere down the road.
Is it streaming anywhere?
I'm sure it is.
All right. Why not?
And remember we. These don't have to be streaming. That's
we've got our movies already set up.
The club meeting is key for streaming. This one doesn't have to be.
June's
2 Days, 1 Night is streaming on Netflix, by the way.
June's we just finished April's.
Yeah.
Even though it's May 8th. We just finished April's, which is 2 Days, 1 Night. June's is going to be Alfred Hitchcock's The 39 Steps.
Oh.
Remember?
Okay.
We had a meeting about this, and we talked about it.
All right.
And you nodded in agreement said yes.
That's great. I love that.
While you were on your phone ignoring me.
I have a lot to cover there. Yes, I love the 39 Steps.
August's is Alexander Sokurov's Russian Ark.
Right, yes. Okay, then I think for sure then that...
October's will be the Avengers.
Okay. And then in December, we'll do
something
Christmas.
Something Christmas, yeah.
So these will all be available.
Now you all know what's coming.
These will all be available for $1.99 each.
And if you're a subscriber, you get them free.
I'm going to get to that part.
Yeah.
These are $1.99 each. You can PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Tell us where to send them and which ones you want. Or you could become a Patreon subscriber. And if you subscribe at the $7 a month level, you get all the new Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes as they emerge. And then if you subscribe at $12 or higher, you get... all of them ever like the whole history of, because this is our 12th one now.
Oh, is it really?
I believe.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Look at us.
Indeed.
So yeah, you get access to all of those as part of your membership perks.
Look at that.
Oh, look whose phone is on.
Yeah, I'll fix that.
Thank you. So tell me about Green Room, because I haven't seen it and I hear really good things.
Well, it's been out for about a month now.
Yes.
And I managed to miss all of the press screenings.
Which surprised me, because it's a movie about punkers.
Indeed, punkers.
And you're such a punker.
Like Mama's Family level punkers. Like Chips level punkers. Like
Quincy
kind of punkers. Punkers.
Dave is referring to various times that 1970s television attempted...
And 80s television.
And 80s television attempted to portray the punk rock lifestyle and got it tragically wrong.
And yet, adorably great.
No, it's very entertaining.
If you just Google Mama's Family, punk. Quincy, punk. Chips, punk.
If anybody got it right...
The Day My Kid Turned Punk,
oh,
which
yes.
is an after-school special.
Yes, starring Bernie Coppell.
Any of those, you can't go wrong.
Do you know who I think actually got it right?
That's something we should do on LKTV. We should watch all the
punk
episodes of stuff.
I like that.
And do that for LKTV.
I like that.
$4 a month for LKTV. Okay, that's the end of pitching
yes,
you
we'll
things.
Stop.
Okay.
You know what? I think the show that got punk right was WKRP in Cincinnati.
I don't remember their punk episode.
They had a British punk band called like Saliva or something visits the station, and they're just like completely rude and obnoxious, and like they're trying to do this on-air interview and they're not participating at all. And then during the commercial break, they're like, "Oh, ask us about blah blah blah." I'm like, "Oh, okay, fine." And then they come back and they ask them about blah blah, blah and they don't respond. Like they have no answer to it. Like, they're just terrible. And I thought, okay, that's actually maybe more true to life.
Well, in Green Room, the punk stuff is accurate.
Okay, good.
It is about a band on a pretty crappy tour in a van. The name of their band is the Ain't Rights. It's Aaliyah Shawkat. It's... I'm blanking now on these names. Can you pause it while I pull
it's
them up?
It's Anton Yelkin.
Can you pause it while I pull it up?
Oh, fine.
Because I shouldn't ruin this.
Too late.
Anton Yelchin, or Yelkin.
I think it's Yelkin.
Aaliyah Shawkat. Joe Cole, he was on Skins, and he's been in a bunch of stuff.
American Skins or UK Skins?
Callum Turner. Well, they're all... Well, everyone except Anton Yelkin and Aaliyah Shawkat are British.
Oh, okay.
And so, the opening scene of this movie, they're being interviewed by a kid in the Bay Area who is interviewing them for his college radio station. And the kid doing this interview is a very, very specific kind of punk rock young man.
Mm-hmm.
And as I watched how the film portrayed him, I was thinking, oh God, this is my friend Derek from college. When I was at Texas Tech in Lubbock, Derek was my roommate in this big house that we lived in. It was not a punk house. And one of the great things about Derek was that he and I were on the same page as far as cleanliness. Derek was super clean about everything. Like, everything was alphabetized, everything was orderly, everything was vacuumed, everything was clean. And the band goes to his house to be interviewed for a college radio station, and they kind of treat his records badly, and I could just see from the orderliness of this apartment that this kid lived in, that I was like, oh, you guys are jerks. You're ruining his records. And whatever... death befalls you in this film is something that now you deserve. Yeah. Well, so the gig that he has them booked for, it is a disaster. Mm-hmm. Falls through. So he has to give them, he has to figure out a way to help them make some money so that they can get home. because they don't have money for gas or food or anything to get home. Mm-hmm. This is the last stop on their tour. So he calls his cousin and he says, can they come play at blah, blah, blah place up in the Pacific Northwest?
Mm-hmm. And what's home for them?
DC.
Yeah.
So they wind up at basically a neo-Nazi white power skinhead
compound
underground, you know, bar.
Mm-hmm.
Run by Patrick Stewart. Although you don't see him right away. And the guy who's got them booked, he says, look, this is what you're going to. And they're like, okay. And he says, just play your early stuff. Don't. Just stay safe. Play your early stuff. Here's the one part of the movie that I don't buy. They chose not to stay safe. In terms of their performance. The first song they do for this gang of white power skinheads is the Dead Kennedys' Nazi Punks F Off.
Oh, jeez.
Here's the best part. I saw this movie with Matt Severson, my art film bro.
Right.
And when they started, they didn't even say what song they were doing. Mm-hmm. They just started into it. And they started doing the song. And I thought, oh, and I laughed out loud.
Because you knew what it was.
And I turned to Matt and I go, do you know what this song is? And he's like, no. Can you understand the words? No. I go, well, this is the Dead Kennedys, Nazi Punks, F Off. And he's like, oh, that's funny. Okay, so anyway, this does not endear them to the crowd.
No.
So they're already in kind of hot water. And then they witness a murder.
Oops.
In the green room. Someone has been stabbed in the head. And the club owner says, you have to stay here in the green room until we sort this out. And then all hell breaks loose. And they have to escape. Because the neo-Nazi skinheads are not of a mind to let them leave.
Woo. Now, you did not see Blue Ruin, right?
I have not yet seen Blue Ruin. Mm-hmm. Here's the best part. I would like to state for the record, for the rest of my and her life, never to goof on or laugh at Imogen Poots's name again. Although I really want to because she has a great name and it's Poots.
You just broke your own rule.
I know. Okay.
That didn't last. Is she... What? Why? What does she do?
She's magnificent in this film as one of the Nazi punk girls. Every step of the way, she has something to say about their predicament. And invariably, it's, are we leaving now? Can we leave? Are we leaving now? Like, it's, she's so deadpan and so great and so moving.
Does she get the American accent?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, because she has it all.
I didn't recognize her for a minute because of her get up and the accent. Yeah. Okay. Here's what's really wonderful about this film. First of all, it's gory as hell. It combines a lot of elements. Exploitation film, horror movie, suspense, you know, that hybrid. But it is so well made. Jeremy Saulnier, I don't know how you say his last name, but the Blue Ruin guy.
Yeah.
He's a director to look out for.
Yeah, apparently so.
I hope they don't stick him in some giant franchise. I mean, yeah, I want everybody to make a lot of money if they can, but I hope he figures out a way to stick to his own path.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's someone, really, I think, to watch. There are so many cool directorial choices. The placement of people and bodies in the action. You know, he has this ability to remember that it's a story about human beings and not merely about human beings being, you know, chopped up.
Right.
And, you know, he wasn't the editor, but the editing is so precise and it screws around with horror editing so that what you think is going to happen and when it's going to happen, it doesn't exactly happen that way. It's slightly off of traditional horror movie editing.
Hmm.
It looks great. It's just so many great artistic visual choices and elements here. I know I'm super late with talking about it, but I highly recommend this.
All right.
Unless you're really, really squeamish and you can't handle, you know, guts.
I have to say, it's been on my list of like movies I know I should see, but I'm like,
there's a hilarious running joke about what musician would you listen to on a desert island.
Uh-huh.
And it keeps popping up. And the first time they go through it, their choices are real punk.
Yeah.
And then by the middle, they're like, I won't spoil it.
Yeah, no.
Anyway, it's a really cool movie.
All right.
I had a really great time. Definitely see this.
Okay.
Either, you know, in a theater if you can, but streaming, TV, whatever, if you have to.
All right. And we should go back and check out Blue Room at some point.
Blue Ruin.
Yeah. Sorry. Also this week.
Oh, and Harasser.
Has a song in it.
Has a song in the movie. And it's, you know, Harasser is the band on my audiobook.
We pointed that out.
I just want to say it again.
All right, fine.
Harasser.
also out this week is A Bigger Splash, which is Luca Guadagnino's follow-up to...
You just pronounced that really nicely.
Thank you. Yeah. His art house hit I Am Love from a few years back. This one also stars Tilda Swinton as a Bowie-esque rock star, surprise.
Yes.
Who is on vocal rest, so she actually spends most of the movie not talking.
Recovering from surgery.
Yeah.
And the first 50% of the movie, she's totally silent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody else talks, though. Especially Ralph Fiennes.
She is taking her vocal rest at a lovely villa with her boyfriend, Matthias Schoenertz. And along comes for a visit her manager, Ralph Fiennes, and his much younger girlfriend, Dakota Johnson.
No, not girlfriend.
Oh, daughter.
Sorry.
His daughter, who people think is his girlfriend, and he's delighted when they do that. Sorry, right. His daughter.
He's a little too delighted.
Ralph Fiennes digs into this like...
a human oil slick.
Well, I was going to say like Ben Kingsley in Sexy Beast.
Yeah.
Like... He is...
repellent.
Yeah.
He's absolutely repellent.
And having a great time playing a character who's totally different from what he usually gets to do in movies. And so there's, you know, it's a gorgeous movie, but it's also a four people in a house movie.
Yeah.
You know, so there's lots of, you know, people screwing with each other's heads and that kind of thing. The windstorm that is mentioned in Act 1 comes to fruition in Act 3, and other things happen, and I thought it kind of fell apart at the end. The plot sort of overtakes the rest of it.
Explain what you mean by that.
It felt like this sort of really solid character piece with these four people, and then suddenly things start happening, and it seems like this sort of traffic jam of...
Were you not expecting... I don't want to give stuff away.
No, I don't either.
But were you not expecting... But I want to flesh out more details. They are all in this house together.
Yeah.
And the sexual tension between all four of these people crisscrossing back and forth from every person to every other person in the house is... thick and sweaty.
You know, okay.
This filmmaker has a sense of
sense.
Yeah.
Like when
his relationship to the sensual is so physical You can like you can taste it and hear it and if this were Willy Wonka's lickable wallpaper, the snozzberries exactly. would taste like banging.
When I taught the course in filmmaking challenges, I would show them I Am Love as an example of how to present the other three senses in film. You know, like yes, the sight and sound is we take that for granted, but how do you convey scent and taste and touch in a movie? And I feel like in I Am Love is one of the great examples of how you do that.
Yes,
and in this movie, there's a lot of that as well.
It's nonstop.
Yeah, you totally get these sensations of what's going on.
I think what makes maybe you
okay, for instance,
think somewhat less of it is that it's a lighter touch.
And I'm fine with that. But I think, okay, for example, there is an ongoing subplot about refugees.
There is.
Because, you know, a lot, as I discovered from having gone I've seen a lot of documentaries of this, both when I went to the Venice Film Festival and at that film festival in Kosovo, where they would talk about how a lot of Eastern European refugees will travel into the Mediterranean and land on Italy or, you know, or Sicily or, you know, that part of the world. And that's their entry into the West.
Yes.
And so there's this whole kind of subplot about refugees coming to this island where they are, or whatever. And I didn't feel like that ever really got anywhere. Like it was maybe there was supposed to be some sort of metaphor going on, but it didn't.
It's always
it didn't
in
land
the background. The refugee crisis in Europe is always in the background here. But you didn't feel like it was well integrated?
It didn't feel germane to the rest of the movie.
Here's what I think was going on. You're right. The first 85 to 90% of this film is people hanging out.
Yes.
And will they or won't they get naked and do it?
Right.
Meanwhile, like you said, there's the refugee thing going on in the back. But there's also these four people and their relationships to the local Italian folks that are coming in and out of the house. There is their relationship to a detective that shows up close to the end.
Right. Who is apparently played by an Italian TV comedian.
I'm not surprised by that.
And his casting did not play well with the
are
first time
sure
I saw
it. Was the casting that didn't play well or his character's behavior?
Well, it was a combination of things.
Because his character's behavior, if it were not from an Italian director, I would think it was insulting to Italians.
Right. Well, and I'm talking about how the Italians responded. Because the Italians apparently don't like Guadagnino. Like, he's big everywhere else in the world.
I wonder why they don't like him.
I've heard various theories. But they really didn't like the casting of that guy as the police detective. And I was telling
Do they think that he makes them look silly?
I think they think that it throws the tone off. You know, like there's this movie that's fairly serious, and then suddenly this, you know, Mr. Wacky shows up.
No. I mean the Guadagnino, the director. Do they think he makes Italians look ridiculous?
Oh, I don't think that's the reason.
In general,
I don't know. I think maybe he's been a jerk in interviews. Like, I don't know. But it's one of those things where there are people where like they're international sensations, but at home they are not liked. And he is one of them.
Right.
And in fact, at the end of the screening in Venice, everybody went.
There was a booing.
The Italians all went. Woo, woo, woo.
Which is their booing.
Yeah, and I'd ask somebody, is that good or bad? That's booing in Italy, apparently. So I think that it kind of unravels a bit, but all the stuff before the unraveling is so good that it's still totally worth seeing for the four lead performances, you know.
I feel like
and for what he does as a director.
I feel like everything that those four characters did in their hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
That the tension between them, and not just the sexual tension, but the rage that was building up among a few specific people.
Right.
I feel like that was enough to warrant the stuff that happens in the final chunk.
All right.
Now, I also think that there's another thing going on here, specifically regarding the subplot about refugees.
Mm-hmm.
I feel as though these four non-Italians who have come here to, you know, be rich and eat and hang out.
Right.
And maybe or maybe not bone each other.
To hide from the world.
I feel like the film sort of, over the running time, presents them to you as kind of privileged jerks.
Oh, well, yeah, that's unquestionable, no doubt.
And even to the point of they have a possible interaction with refugees, a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not good.
Yeah.
So I feel like the contrast between, you know, the desperate people from a war region,
right,
who are clinging to anything they can get, and wind up on this luxurious and beautiful island where rich people go to frolic.
Mm-hmm.
And those refugees are in a cage by the end of the movie.
Right.
As they breeze through past the cage, the four people.
Yeah.
Well, three of them. and I can't give away the ending, but it seems to me to be a film about a kind of, you know, have and have not class war situation.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, like I said, there's a metaphor going on with it, and I see what he's sort of shooting at, but it didn't totally land
for me. Meanwhile, the first, like you say, the first 85% of the film is straight up Euro art house
longer
sex movie.
Yeah.
You'll be turned on by a lot of the things that go down in this movie.
Yeah.
It is to the art house what Captain America, I think, is to the multiplex in terms of summer movie seasons here.
Here's what you
and
want.
And here's, for the art house, a Euro movie about rich white people maybe getting it on and definitely not wearing many clothes.
In sunbaked Italian villas.
Yeah, so whoever floats your boat in this movie, whether it's Dakota Johnson or Ralph Fiennes, if you're into that loush sort of Scott Walker ruined sort of thing.
Loush.
Sorry. Mispronunciating things again.
Matthias Schoenaerts. He's a tasty bit.
And
Tilda.
And Tilda, who's, you know.
Okay. And Ralph,
the sex alien of the world.
Ralph Fiennes' lip syncing of the Rolling Stones is pretty great.
Well, he doesn't lip sync. He sings live.
Oh, that's true. You're right. Yeah, sorry.
Badly.
But he's singing.
It's been so long since you've seen this
but
film.
But he's singing to an album.
Yeah.
You
saw it over a year ago.
I saw it last September.
Okay, so 9 months ago.
Yes.
Yeah. Still, long time ago.
Would you say that it is better than I Am Love?
No.
Okay, fair enough.
No, not at all. It is... I Am Love is such a mysterious film and so just sumptuous.
Yes. Yeah,
everything about it.
But this one is absolutely worth seeing.
Although part of I Am Love's appeal was Tilda Swinton's outfits, and they are equally on point in this film. Ralph Simons for Christian Dior.
Yes.
If you stay through the credits, you'll find that out.
We were joking about this on What the Flick, because it is not based... The title is referencing the David Hockney painting, but it is not a remake of the David Hockney film, that also called A Bigger Splash.
Nor is it a sequel to
And it is a remake...
Splash.
Nor is it a sequel to Splash. And it's a remake of a film called La Piscine, but it is not a remake of François Ozon's Swimming Pool.
Correct.
So just so we're clear.
Although there is a lot of swimming going on.
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Family Fang.
Right. Talk about what that movie's about.
Okay. Jason Bateman, who directed, and Nicole Kidman are the kind of messed up adult children of these sort of conceptual / performance artists. Is that a fair description?
Yeah.
Who the parents actually involved them in these elaborate kind of art pranks and happenings throughout their childhood. And now as adults... They have their own degrees of mess behind it. And so Bateman is a blocked novelist, and Kidman is an actress who's trying to be taken seriously as a legit actress after sort of beginning her career with these sort of kind of outrageous, you know,
successful films. Actress, but her career is known for its kind of boring rom-coms.
Right, but early on, wasn't she sort of like a... Like, I got the impression like she
early on she was this indie darling.
Yes.
And then she broke through to the mainstream with these terrible rom-coms.
Right.
And now she's at a crossroads with her career. She doesn't quite know what to do next.
Right.
Yeah.
So during all this, they wind up, God, remind me, why do they go home to their parents?
Because on an article, on assignment for an article, Jason Bateman is shot in the head by a potato gun.
Yes, I forgot.
He ruptures his eardrum, and he has to go back to the family home to recuperate.
Right, because he can't get on a plane because he's got this head injury.
Yes.
And so he begs the sister to come visit so he's not alone with the parents.
So now all four of them are back together in the same house. The parents are played by...
Christopher Walken.
And I'm blanking on and the name.
It's weirdly non-famous woman because the younger version of the mother is played by Catherine Hahn.
Yeah.
But she's good, though. Anyway, and so while they're there, the parents try to sort of inveigle them into doing another art thing with them, and they're not feeling it at this point. And so the parents get upset and say they're gonna take off for a while. And there is an accident, and there's been a rash of murders happening at highway rest stops, and it would appear from all evidence that the parents have been abducted and murdered.
Marianne Plunkett. Valentine, the squid and the whale.
Oh, okay.
She's married to J.O. Sanders.
Oh, all right.
So there you go.
Anyway, so while everyone thinks that the parents are dead, Bateman and Kidman are not convinced, so they decide to do a little sleuthing of their own.
They believe this is the ultimate performance on their parents' part.
Exactly.
Yes.
And throughout the film, we see footage of a documentary that a mentor of Walken's was making about them that was never completed. And so one of the scenes is these two art critics arguing over whether or not what the Fangs did was really art or not. And I really like that scene because so often in movies that are about art or even just like about a writer or a musician, a lot of times we'll be presented with a sample of their work and are told, aren't they great? And a lot of times you're thinking, well, no, that's actually kind of crappy, but I have to believe that the people in the film think it's great because everybody in the film thinks this person is great. And so that scene at least allowed me to be like, okay, so if you think that what they do is garbage, like the movie acknowledges that some people in the art world think that way too, and that other people in the art world think that it isn't. So, you know, it's not trying to make you believe anything about the quality of the work that these people are doing.
Although I will say that I don't believe that conversation, the one you're referencing, it doesn't feel like a conversation between two people who are actual art critics.
All right. Yeah. Well, I'm sure
based on the art critics that I read fairly regularly, these guys are being it's art critics being translated for an audience.
I was going to say, I'm sure they had to be translated into human for the rest of us to understand what they were on about.
I'm a human and I understand it.
You're a weirdo and you subscribe to Art Forum. So the rest of us are not, we're not next level art bros like you. This was based on a novel that apparently is fairly popular and written by David Lindsay Abaire, who wrote Rabbit Hole, which Kidman starred in.
Yes.
And has also like since written some crappy movies, but I forget what. He's getting paid. Anyway, I rather like this film. I think Bateman and Kidman are both really good, and I was sort of interested in kind of just the family dynamic and how, even though it's a very, you know, exaggerated writ large version, it still kind of comes down to basic issues about parents and children and expectations and you know, becoming your own person and that kind of stuff. And especially being an artist who is the child of other artists and having to create your own voice and create your own reputation and that kind of thing. But I really wanted Dave to see it because, you know more about the art world than I did. And I was wondering what you would think.
I didn't like it.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't like it.
Do you think it's at least better than Bateman's previous film, Bad Words?
somewhat better.
Okay.
I don't think he's a terrible filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
but I think that the tone of his movies so far, these two films, have left me really cold. I believe that there are people in his films who behave fairly despicably. And if he sees it, I don't know that he cares too much about that. And I feel as though particularly this, I think this film, his character is a bit of a know-it-all. He's the only one, his character is the only one person in the film who really sees what's happening and really knows the way through for this family. And he's just sort of waiting around for everyone else to catch up to his way of thinking. When Nicole Kidman, who clearly cares more about rehabilitating the family structure, when she speaks to him, his response to her more than once or twice what is just a deadpan stare. Like, as in, well, you know how I feel about this. And I'm right. And I don't know why you care. Because they've been such jerks to us, these parents. If anything...
That's not the way I read it, but go on.
If anything, I feel like these parents, although they treat the Christopher Walken in particular, treats his adult children with disdain and derides their career choices.
Right.
Going so far as to say that, you know, neither one of them is actually an artist when they are both artists. One is an actor, one is a writer.
Yeah.
And yet because they aren't rubbing the world's face in anything.
Right.
They aren't real artists.
Well, and I think he probably felt the same way about the wife's, you know, drawn paintings, which were quite...
Which is why she hides them from him.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, so I mean, obviously we're not meant to agree with him.
I understand that.
Okay.
But at the same time, we are told that, you know, these people are famous in the art world, that they're important.
Yeah.
And if anyone has an axe to grind with these people, it's every innocent bystander that gets traumatized by something they do in public.
Right, and Nicole Kidman's character says that.
Yeah.
You know, when they're having the argument about, you know, what a great experience it was for the kids, and she was like, yeah, but, you know, all those bystanders walked away, and it's never part of their thing again.
They walked away. What she doesn't say is, you simulated
a bank robbery.
A bank robbery with killing.
Right.
In front of, you know, total strangers. And then had the nerve to take a bow and say, essentially, you're welcome, everybody.
Right.
I don't believe, honestly, based on my experience with watching the art world exist.
Yeah.
I don't believe they would get away with that. No, I don't, not necessarily that they wouldn't get away with the performance, because they would just go and do the performance. But I don't believe the art world
would take them necessarily
all that seriously.
Well,
there has been a tradition of performance art through essentially the whole 20th century, including performance art that involves public space, you know, going at least all the way back to the Cubists, Futurists in Russia, who did, you know, stuff in the 19-teens,
the Dadaists, right?
I'm kind of an autodidact, so, you know, whatever I don't know about what happened before the early teens of the 20th century, you know, you've, people, you've, they do reference Chris Burden in the film as someone who very famously was shot in a performance. It took place in a gallery. And then someone in the film says, well, you know, that it's if you do this in a gallery, it's not really affecting anything.
Right.
You have to go out into the world and do these things. Well, no, you go out into the world and do these things, and you've, again, traumatized people who didn't ask to be a part of your little project.
Right.
And honestly, characters weren't sued multiple times is a surprise
They kind of struck me as like being the yes men without a political agenda.
Yeah. Yeah. Except the yes men have...
political agenda is the point.
The yes men are punching up.
Mm, true, yeah.
And these people seem to be constantly either punching laterally or down.
Like, we want to shake you out of your suburban complacency,
we're
man.
We're here to show you
what life is like.
How freedom really works.
Right.
You know?
I don't know, there
is a tradition...
Again, because the movie didn't insist that I take the art seriously.
It does not insist that you take the art seriously. I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
And so that's not even the thing that bothers me the most.
Okay.
What bothers me the most is I think that the family story in this is pretty facile and not especially interesting. You've got people who are, you know, experiencing a fairly typical dysfunctional family situation. The circumstances are a little different because, again, these people are performance artists who may or may not be murdered. I won't give away what actually happens in the end, but you do find out.
Well, yeah, and I found that aspect of it interesting and the whole...
But that's not the interesting... That's the only interesting thing, the thing that you find out about what happened to the parents.
But I think the process by which Kidman and Bateman have to piece together what did or didn't happen... And the way that brings them together, I found interesting as well.
I feel like the film has an understanding of hurt and resentment. But I think it has very little to say about how you deal with that. Outside of simply shutting down and shutting off. And getting and completely distancing yourself from the people who have traumatized you.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be the message that Bateman's character keeps trying to say to Nicole Kidman. And I just feel that attitude that his character walks through the film with is kind of smug and as uncaring in terms of, you know, trying to help her through it as Walken's character is to the feelings of his own children.
Maybe, but I'll tell you, it was interesting to see a movie about people who have a fractured relationship with their parents.
Yes.
That kind of comes down on the side of, you know what? Maybe you weren't supposed to. Maybe these people were incapable of that, and rather than trying to, you know, fish that out of them or fix it or make it happen, maybe sometimes the best thing for everybody is to walk away.
The film is saying that. But I don't think it's saying it in a very sophisticated way.
Okay.
I don't think it's saying it in a very thoughtful or empathetic way. I feel like it's going for cheap emotions, cheap realizations. I don't find this an effective family drama really at all.
All right.
I think Kidman is pretty good.
I think she's quite good.
Yeah, I think Kidman's pretty good in this. And I always like her. I'm always down for her.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Even when she's in crap. But, you know, she's given it what she's got to give in this movie. I just don't, you know.
All right.
I don't think it's a great movie.
Okay. Well, it is playing on demand. Wherever you are in the United States, you can watch this movie on iTunes or Amazon. So, you know, if you feel like it, have a look.
Here's another thing.
See who you agree with.
Here's another thing.
What?
She's a movie star.
Right.
In the film.
Yeah.
Why doesn't anyone recognize her anywhere they go? They go out in public, and even once they accompany the parents on a performance as adults, and no one is like, oh, hey, look, that movie star. What's she doing here?
Doesn't she usually have, like, sunglasses or something on? Or
no.
No? Oh, well. No. Dunno.
There are two actual artists who disappeared And one of them, it's clear that he
staged it.
Over time, it's clear that he did kill himself.
Oh,
Ray Johnson. The other one is Bastian Otter, who he got in a 13-foot-long boat and decided to sail across the Atlantic. Yeah, they found the boat eventually. They didn't find him. Mm-hmm. And to this day, there are people who be like, what if he's alive somewhere? And you're like, no! He was dinner for a shark or something.
Maybe he is a croupier on the Queen Mary.
Maybe he is. No. They both died.
Gotcha.
But Bastian Otter's disappearance is actually still
discussed.
Discussed. Yeah.
Okay, Captain America Civil War.
Yes. So, okay.
Which I saw some headline that said, why Captain America Civil War is not an Avengers movie? And I thought, I'm not reading that because you're wrong.
At the end of Ultron, they ruined the fictional land of Sokovia.
Correct.
And lots of innocent folks died. At the beginning of this movie, there's another bad guy situation that's going down. Mm-hmm. And they have to, you know, attack the bad guys, fight the bad guys. This happens in Lagos, Nigeria.
Right.
And a lot of innocent people die here as well.
Oops.
Which leads the United Nations to come up with the Sokovia Accords.
Under the guidance of Secretary of State Thunderbolt Ross, played by William Hurt from The Incredible Hulk.
And
I'd forgotten that he was in the MCU.
What this is a way to regulate superhero activity. To keep them from just doing as they please.
Right.
Wherever they please. And Vision, played by Paul Bettany, who was introduced in Ultron.
Right.
He sits everybody down and he says, okay, look. Since the first of you showed up, the number of what is now known as enhanced human beings,
right,
the number of superheroes just keeps multiplying. We've got more and more and more of them. The more than ever, we've got a lot of them.
Well, and I think that he means in villains as well.
Well, then he says, concurrently, mm-hmm, as superheroes have multiplied, so have planet-threatening events. Which leads him to figure, logically, that perhaps the existence of superheroes themselves is an inciting event. That if we didn't have the superheroes, we wouldn't have people from space trying to come down and destroy the entire planet. Specifically, the ones who are chasing, you know, Thor. But now anybody else, you know, all these other people. The folks who are somehow attached to the Winter Soldier, who also pops up in this movie.
Right.
I won't say why, but he's enough of a why that Captain America, Steve Rogers, played by Chris Evans, says, look, I've got some business to deal with here with the Winter Soldier, and it's really important that I do this, and if I sign this Sokovia Accord, really terrible stuff is going to happen, and my hands will be tied, and all of our hands will be tied.
Right.
And you have to trust us to go do the things we need to do.
Yeah, his objection to signing the accord isn't just this current thing, but in general, the idea that the government can make them go to places that they don't want to go and stop them from going to places where they do want to go.
Yes.
I mean, it's weird because neither side is completely right on this one.
Right.
Because the Iron Man thing is basically like where the superheroes become basically the lackeys of the UN.
Yes.
And then Captain America's thing is a little Ayn Rand for my taste in terms of just like,
we get
to do what we want. So I don't know that I'm team
You
either.
Only believe him because he's Captain America.
Sure.
If it were anyone else, you'd say, You have a seat.
Yeah, you have an agenda.
Right.
So big schism forms. Team Iron Man, you have Black Widow, War Machine, Vision.
And the rest. And then Team Captain America is other ones.
Falcon, Scarlet Witch.
Yes.
I mean, look,
Whose side is Ant-Man on?
He's Team Cap.
Okay, yeah. Ant-Man comes along.
There are new characters in this movie, but they've been on the billboards, so it wouldn't be a spoiler to talk about them, but whatever, you'll find out if you don't know.
You know, I left them out of my review for the wrap.
Right. No,
I left out the new characters.
Yeah, we did a spoiler because and a non-spoiler.
As we discussed before I saw the film, I managed not to know... Thanks, bubble that I've created for myself. My perfect little bubble. My beautiful, darling, adorable bubble in which I live. I managed not to know who any of the new characters were that were coming to this film. Each new one surprised me. And when they would show up, I'd be like, oh, hey, that's going to be blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And whoa, look who it is over here.
Somebody should throw you a surprise party. You would never see it coming.
Yeah, maybe.
Oh, look at that. Golly.
No, this isn't naivete. This is intentional.
I know.
I shield myself from as much as I possibly can.
Get it, shield.
I didn't know until recently that there was another Harry Potter movie coming.
Yeah, no, I know. We had that discussion on this program.
Then I saw the trailer in Jungle Book, and I was like, ooh, look at that. Another Harry Potter movie coming. That's not about Harry Potter at all, really. No, but
it's a prequel.
But it's a, yeah. It looks like it's a lot of fun.
You liked Civil War more than I did.
I liked it a lot. I had a really good time.
I think there is...
I'm okay with the long storytelling. It's 2.5 hours because they got 47 people.
Well, that's
the movie.
That's
so
the thing. This movie,
I'm settling in.
I feel like they are cramming 10 pounds of movie into a 5-pound sack. Like, there is so much going on here and so many characters.
And every moment is a plot, like,
motor.
Turn of the screw, yeah.
Yeah. And, I got a little tired. You know, it didn't hold up the pace because there was just so much. And then
Grandpa, maybe you ought to be a little more young and with it and effervescent like me.
Yes. Youthful, fresh, fun. Yeah. Also, there is a big, big, big fight scene that happens at the end of Act 2.
Yeah.
Or it's a 4-act movie and it happens at the end of Act 3. But in any event, like, this big thing happens. And I was like, okay, whew. And then there was like a scene.
Wow, it's over.
I thought I was waiting.
Like 40 more minutes
I kept
go.
Thinking, like, the credits were going to start rolling. And then suddenly, like, oh, no, there's a hole. We're not leaving yet. Okay.
Yeah, we're not done.
Mentally, I was having to sort of put my coat back on the chair again. You know, I was not quite ready for that. And so the pacing is a little weird. I think there's more going on than needs to be. And I didn't find the plot as compelling as Winter Soldier was. I thought that movie was so interesting because it felt like... It felt more mature. It felt like they were balancing kind of real life situations or concerns with these sort of, you know, superhero movie concerns.
I think Winter Soldier is better than this.
I thought the character stuff as far as this guy kind of coping with the modern world was more interesting.
Yes.
So you know, it was a on that front it was a bit of a letdown. I mean, it is better than Ultron. It's better than a lot of the MCU movies, but not as good as the previous Captain America movie. So for me, that was a little bit of a disappointment, but nonetheless the big moments that deliver really deliver, and I was entertained, even though I was occasionally overwhelmed. You know, it was fun.
I agree. I had a really good time. I probably had a better time than you. I don't have really, and I've said this every time one of these movies comes out, I don't have anything invested in any of this.
No, I know.
I have literally nothing invested but my own good time. And the fact that the Captain America movies in particular are dealing with political subtext on any level,
mm-hmm.
I think that is the thing that, critics and more serious audiences
glean from them.
Hang their hats on quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, I don't come in with an agenda in terms of like, I mean, yes, I read the comic books, but I don't have this sort of checklist in my mind of like, oh, I hope we get to see them.
As
you
know, much...
Like, I didn't read the Civil War comics, right. Which are...
Yes.
If you have not read those comics and you want kind of a quick nugget of what they're about, listen to the Comics Canon podcast that our friend Kurt Holman co-hosts. They sort of encapsulated the whole run of the thing, and it's there are elements of that that turn up in this movie, but it's rather different.
Comics Canon, like T-shirt Canon, like CANNON.
No, like CANNON.
CANNON, like Canon,
like the
stuff that happens in a thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, stuff that happens in a thing.
That's basically that's the definition of canon. Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that Winter Soldier may be the most serious-minded Marvel film that we've had to date.
Sure, no question.
And I'm wondering how much more of that they will seek to include in these films. I don't know, and I'm willing to let them go either way. I think that it would be a mistake, though, say 20 years from now, to come back and, in hindsight, create more importance for these topical political subtexts than they ever intended.
Well, this movie to me doesn't feel like, oh, we need to backpedal from that, you know?
No. I don't mean that. I mean, like, future thought on these films. Mm-hmm. Will we look back on them and say about them, these were significant films because they engaged with the political, political urgency of the moment.
You've always pointed out that all of the superhero movies operate in a post 9/11.
That is correct.
And context.
That is true. And I do believe that they are informed by that. And some of them comment more on it than others. They're all inextricably tangled up in that.
Yes.
No matter what they want to do, no matter what their intentions are.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if because of that, you know, in the future, we're going to look back and say, well, look how important these films were because of this.
Oh, I see what you mean.
You see what I'm saying?
Well, like, at this point, Winter Soldier, I think, is the only one that would rank in that. But I don't, but this movie, in its difference from the Winter Soldier, doesn't feel like a failure of nerve as much as we've got a lot to get through. Exactly.
Right.
It's the usual sort of superhero real estate issue of like, we got to pack all these people in and we got to set up these movies and these sequels and these, this and the
yeah.
You know, and so there's no time to actually kind of pause and go into the deeper ramifications of what this movie might actually be saying about the world that we live in.
Right. Yeah, because as urgent and crucial as all of these political situations are in the real world to humans with brains right now, these films are, of course, informed by that. They rub up against it, and they sometimes comment on that.
Well, I mean, Jaws is a post-Watergate movie.
Exactly. Right? But in general, other than with, you know, some exceptions like Winter Soldier, not deeply enough or strongly enough to create any sense of motivation in the audience.
No.
Not enough for the audience to walk out and go, you know, I really feel strongly about this or that now.
Well, and even worse are the Zack Snyder movies, where they're basically sort of trafficking in 9/11 imagery.
Without even trying to engage anything.
Exactly, but with nothing to say about it, except for like, ooh, you know, isn't that cool how we can make a building do that? You know?
Yes.
This movie does at least try, there was some complaints about how dare you compare this movie to Batman v Superman. Well, you know, at one point they almost opened on the same day. But
can you imagine?
This movie in trying to examine the human cost of superheroics, which the Snyder movies do in a glancing way, this one raises tough questions that I'm curious to see if and how they're going to be answered, frankly. But you get one scene of Alfred Woodard as like, you know, if she was a superhero,
a great scene,
Gravitas Woman,
right? Yes,
you know, she comes in and lays some smackdown on Tony Stark about collateral damage, and it's like, whoa,
her moment is really good.
Yeah, I would have liked more of that in the movie, I guess, and less like just traffic jam of characters. But you should see it. It's fun. I liked it. And, you know, it's they do these well, those Marvel cats.
In lieu of a DVD this week, I want to talk about a thing that I cannot go to.
Okay.
Which bums me out. We are not in New York City. We are 2,500 miles away from New York City in overcast Los Angeles. MoMA, starting 2 days ago on Friday, is doing what amounts to a complete retrospective, or close to a complete retrospective, of the films of Jean-Marie Straub and Daniel Huillet, or Huillet. Straub-Huillet. That's their directorial, like, name.
Like
their hybrid name. Straub-Huillet.
Powell Pressburger.
Yeah. They were French filmmakers. Straub is still alive. Danielle Huillet, she died in 2006. They made... there's only one word. Difficult movies. And I mean difficult movies. I've got this quote. It's just the best. Hang on. Let me pull it up. The work we have to do is to make films which radically eliminate art so that there is no equivocation. I love that.
I'll be watching The Great Lie on TCM.
Hang on. So, here's the other problem if you don't live in New York near this retrospective. Their movies are, A, like I said, difficult, but really hard to find and get a hold of. And they are people that I had heard of, but had never experienced, because they're the kind of filmmakers whose films, you know, wind up playing in museums.
Are any of these features, or are they all shorts?
No, features. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But they started in the early 60s with shorts, a couple short films. I normally don't say this, but anytime a film is impossible to get a hold of, or the DVD is out of print and super expensive, or not in the, you know, North American region, or whatever like that, if you can find it online to watch, why not? Go do it. And it just so happens that their first two shorts and their first feature, at least, are on YouTube with English subtitles. So, Friday night, I sat myself down and I watched their very first short film, Machorca Muff.
Okay.
It is a short film, but it is basically a feature. And the reason is because they have stripped this thing to the bone so that each minute of this 16, 17 minute film contains this hard element of story. And it's a satire about German rearmament in the 50s. It's based on Heinrich Boll short story called The Bond Diary. I gotta go read this short story now. I gotta get this book. You know, he was a Nobel Prize winning author. And I have a new movie boyfriend, and it's these two people. Because anytime a filmmaker just sort of radically alters my way of looking at a film, they've got me by the tongue. Like, they can lead me anywhere. And so I can already tell that these are the kind of films that I'm going to have to... You know when you read a book that's pretty dense and you have to find yourself rereading passages, entire paragraphs to kind of get where it's going. That's how these guys are. And so...
I never finish books like that.
I'm stoked. Like, this makes me so excited that, you know, at midlife, I'm finally able to, you know, locate these things. Thanks, internet. And, you know, do my own viewing without Moma's help. If we're lucky, it'll come to LACMA. Or at least some of it will come to LACMA.
Knock yourself out.
Oh, you're coming with me.
Nope.
You're coming on this journey with me.
No, thank you.
At least partially.
Not tonight in Vegas. Yes. Thank you. No.
Yes. It's going to be amazing.
I am going to do a DVD pick this week, but it's I Am Love, the previous Luca Guadagnino feature starring Tilda Swinton, which if you haven't seen, you are missing out on something really extraordinary. We have letters to catch up on. Let's do some of those.
I sure do. Pause it so I can dig them up.
Oh, Lordy. Before we get into letters, before I forget, no. I want to give a quick shout out to Daniel, who works at ArcLight Hollywood, who listens to the show.
Who is he?
He recognized me at the Captain America screening and said very nice things about the program.
What's his favorite movie on his name tag?
I forgot to check. What I was going
to
say was
I need to judge him.
I did not get to stop and chat with him because I was sort of Oklahoma land rushing to get to a good seat in there.
Right.
Usually I like to try and stop and talk to folks and, you know, thank them for listening to the show and all that stuff. So I
engaging with your public.
Yes, exactly. I didn't get as much time to do that as I would have liked. So I just wanted to say, Daniel, thank you so much for the nice things you said about the show. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. And I'm sorry we didn't get the chat more. I was not being a jerk. I just...
Oh, you were being a jerk.
Maybe. It's arguable. Anyway.
Come on. Think about all the times you're being a jerk.
But thank you nonetheless. All right. Letters, sir.
This is from Chris. Dear David Alonzo, I'm a big fan of the show. First discovering it through Alonzo, through What the Flick. And I've known Alonzo before that through the Rotten Tomatoes show.
Oh, wow.
And before that, the IFC documentary miniseries Indie Sex.
Oh, yeah.
From 2006, even though I've known Alonzo more, I prefer Dave. Da, 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 da.
No wonder this letter made its way to the top of the stack.
I'm reading this cold.
Uh-huh.
No, this is the one that came as an attachment.
Oh, I see.
I just had to pull it up. I'm literally reading this cold.
Okay. How nice for you.
But it just goes to show, really, that any random letter that comes along probably includes a pro-me sentiment.
It's statistically not true, but go ahead.
I prefer Dave because of his love for art cinema. And his great voice, even though when I first heard it, I thought he was Alonzo's grandpa. Either way, I love you guys. I'm in my early 20s with autism. I'm going to Riverside City College to become a filmmaker, and I've been taking many classes to see how. So far, I've made 4 avant-garde short films that are on YouTube, an animated short film also on YouTube, and 1 short film so bad I cannot let anyone see it.
We've all got work like that.
I have a question. And a top 10 list. Okay. The question is that I'm trying to start a film society at the college.
Oh.
So far, I've been mostly by myself on creating one. I'm still working on the paperwork for it, but I want to know, since Alonzo was part of one, how to manage a film society, such as program it and getting other students to be a part of it.
Interesting. Well, when I did it in college, it already existed, so I didn't have to start anything.
I just waltzed into an existing program.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously the challenge is repertory is hard to do, especially now in the age of streaming video and cable and whatnot, because to get people off their sofas and to pay money to come and at a specific time see a movie, it's tricky, but not impossible. It can be done. I would say talk to other filmmakers, rally other people to get involved, because at least that way you've got more people who will be promoting the program once it gets started. I don't know if you are able to get money out of the college to do this, or if this is something you guys have to front the rentals for yourself. You know, I don't know. I would say take a stab at it and, you know, go for a variety of things. And if you have to do the occasional sort of obvious, like, weekend midnight showing of, you know, The Big Lebowski or Monty Python and the Holy Grail, just as sort of a guaranteed butts in seats kind of movie.
Butts in seats.
You know, a lot of times with these schedules, those are the movies that then underwrite the, you know, your evening of Strobe short films that four people show up to see, you know. But yeah, good luck, and you know, let us know how it goes. It can be a lot of fun, and it can be very fruitful and you know, worthwhile, depending on how it plays out.
You're fruitful and worthwhile.
Oh, thank you. I like to think so.
Here's a list.
Okay.
I decided to make a top 10 list of my favorite filmmakers.
Okay.
And my favorite film from them.
Gotcha.
Okay. From 10 to 1. 10, Bresson, The Trial of Joan of Arc. Dave, you said this was one of the hardest of his films. I think this was the easiest. I don't know that I think it's the hardest. If I did say it was the hardest, that wasn't exactly what I meant. What I think I meant was that for me, it's the bone driest. The one that felt like it might sort of be like homework.
Well, you said it was.
Yeah.
You said it was not a film to start with for him.
I don't. Yeah, I wouldn't call it a film to start with. You start with Bresson with Pickpocket or A Man Escaped.
Right.
That's where you start. I started with Balthazar, and that was all I needed. But when I saw Pickpocket and Man Escaped, I was like, oh, I get it. These are
movies.
These are movies that are more genre based, and they're a form that more people will sort of get immediately into.
Gotcha. Yeah.
One's a prison break movie, one's a movie about a criminal.
Pickpocket. Yeah.
Number 9, Tarantino, Kill Bill 1 and 2.
Okay. I've had to come around on Tarantino. I certainly wouldn't put him as a top 10 anything, but I'll allow it.
8, Andrei Tarkovsky, Andrei Rublev.
Okay.
I have seen all of his films.
Oh.
And Rublev stands as his crowning achievement. I happen to have Andrei Rublev in TiVo.
Oh.
Right now. Because TCM showed it. And it's one of the films that I have not seen by Tarkovsky. And I'm waiting for it to rain.
It's Los Angeles, Dave. It could be a while.
Look, I've got a while. I'll wait. I'm patient. I'm waiting for it to rain.
I'll wait.
Godard, Band of Outsiders.
Okay. Which is about to, that particular
it's,
film is about
it's
to
It's happening right now.
It's being reissued.
It opened at Cinefamily this weekend.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, I want to go.
Yeah.
He says, I love Breathless and Vivre Sa Vie, but Band of Outsiders is still my favorite.
Okay.
Mine's Vivre Sa Vie. That's my favorite.
Hmm.
It's the Cap'n Crunch of of Godard films for
me. I don't
know.
I might go Weekend.
Weekend is the funniest one. Weekend is the most like outlandishly
yeah.
funny.
And I like Masculine Feminine and A Woman is a Woman.
Yeah.
I told you, noted Godard scholar Richard Brody,
yes.
My new best friend, his favorite movie
is
of all time
is
King Lear.
The 80s.
The Godard King
Godard
Lear.
80s
yeah.
with Molly Ringwald.
Yes.
Yeah, we've got it here in the DVD closet. We just haven't sat down to watch it.
It's my old VHS.
It's
copy.
A VHS copy.
Yeah, it's still never been released. It's weird because like the canon movies pop up on different labels.
Yeah.
And whenever some new label is putting out a canon title I've never heard before, I always go, "Hey, do you guys by chance have Shy People in King Lear?" And no one ever does.
And a very dear friend of us gave us the poster.
Yes. Which we need to get framed.
Christmas or two back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kieslowski, Three Colors, blue, white, and red.
Okay.
Oh, no. Blue and red. Those are the two.
Oh.
Yeah.
White always gets short shrift, but
it
I
sure
like that
does.
One, too. Has our dinner friend Julie Delpy in it.
Yes. Paul Thomas Anderson, There Will Be Blood.
Mm-hmm.
David Fincher, Zodiac.
Mm-hmm.
Ingmar Bergman, Persona.
Mm-hmm.
Scorsese, Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, Goodfellas, Casino, Last Temptation to Christ, Bringing Out the Dead. He's into all those Scorsese movies.
Okay.
Number 1, Stanley Kubrick. Strangelove, 2001, Clockwork Orange, Barry Lyndon, Shining, Full Metal Jacket, Eyes Wide Shut. I really like his other films, too.
May
Honorable
I?
Mentions.
Uh-huh.
Hitchcock, Kurosawa, Fellini, Truffaut, Buñuel, Ackerman, Dreyer, Romer, Antonioni, Wes Anderson, David Lynch, Fritz Lang, Steven Soderbergh, Fassbender, Louis Malle, Aki Kaurismäki, Pasolini, thank you for the podcast, Chris of Bloomington, P.S. I know the podcast was named after a lyric from the opening song from Aqua Teen Hunger Force : Movie Film for Theaters.
Correct.
I want to know, do you guys like Aqua Teen Hunger Force : Movie Film for Theaters? I just want to know. Oh, yes.
Oh, totally. Yes.
It is the greatest animated film of all time.
I'm not going to go that far, but we were fans of the show, and I like the movie a lot.
I remember writing my review for movies.com, and in the review I said, this is the greatest animated film of all time.
Eat it, Miyazaki.
Everyone else. That's right. Yeah.
Please, you're wrong.
Of course I'm wrong. But it felt good to say at the time.
Sure, okay.
And it was one of the few times that I looked at the comments that people left, and people were like, this guy's an idiot.
Your list is 100% knife.
Sure is.
I'm glad Chantal Ackerman made the runner-up cut. I would say maybe see some more films by women. Just, why not? It couldn't hurt.
Yes. Anya's Varda.
Gillian Armstrong.
Yes. Just to name
a Ida Lupino.
Couple. Ooh, Ida Lupino.
My experience has been between teaching film students of late and, you know, talking to folks on the internet. The
same American male filmmakers keep coming back up and up?
Yes. Okay. And they're great. Fincher is great. Kubrick is great. They're all awesome. But I believe in the complete breakfast. You know, throw in an MGM musical. Throw in a Frederick Wiseman documentary. Just for giggles. You know, it doesn't all have to be long tracking shots.
Ida Lupino.
Yes.
This is from Daniel. Mm-hmm. This is the last one I'm going to read because we got to get out of here and go to the.
All right. Okay.
We're going to the museum.
Ew. By the way, we have not forgotten that we will be doing an episode where we spoil Midnight Special and The Invitation.
And make up all the pile of letters.
No, we can't do both because some people are going to want to not hear the spoilers and hear
letters. Oh, yeah. Well, we'll figure it out.
All right.
Hi, guys. Alonzo talking about Death Becomes Her reminded me of something that I've been meaning to ask you. Could you talk a little bit about camp?
Hmm.
I take it that you use it to mean something that is unintentionally funny. Would this mean that, say, Valley of the Dolls or Mommy Dearest is camp, but Girls Will Be Girls or the plays of Charles Bush are not? I know in England, camp means anything flamboyantly gay.
Right.
But I'm interested in your take on it. Thanks.
Whenever I'm asked this question, I always turn to Susan Sontag.
Pretty much.
And the idea is of camp being something that is an accident, that was intended to be dramatic and for whatever failings of its crafting emerges as comedy instead.
And comes from queer culture. Back in the bad old days,
mm-hmm.
when they used to arrest you for having a mincy walk.
Sissy that walk.
Gay men having to sort of, you know, endure the relentless and oppressive heterosexuality of every single thing created by the culture. Every love song was from a boy to a girl or a girl to a boy. Every movie was about a romance between a woman and a man. That gets to be a bummer when you are locked out of that. And not just locked out of it, but told that there's something, you know, intrinsically disordered about you. Gay people responded by reading these cultural objects in their own way. By taking the self-seriousness of quite a bit of it.
Of the melodrama.
And mocking it.
Yeah.
In very highly coded ways of secret language that was just for queer people. Over time, you know, we didn't have to be so hiding all the time. You know, thank God it happened in my lifetime and started when I was a little tiny little child, so that by the time I got to be an adult, things were not so rotten.
Right.
Still kind of rotten, but not the worst that they had been.
Absolutely.
And now in the United States, if you're, you know, living in a big city, things are basically fine.
Yeah.
For you. Camp was a strategy for...
It was a code.
For reading culture.
Yeah.
And it often nailed itself hard to serious art that was failing.
Yes.
And so, you know, something that was attempting to be serious and was just ludicrous. That's why you can look at a movie like Valley of the Dolls and see what's going on. And at the same time, see what's absurd about it.
Right. And, you know, but then, you know, you have these offshoots of what do you call something that is doing it on purpose? You know,
I don't know really what you call that.
The
now.
1968 that Batman TV show, you know,
we've decided, yeah, we've decided that campy is an adjective describing things that are over the top and intentionally ridiculous.
Yeah. And then you get into the tricky situation of things like the films of Douglas Sirk.
Yes.
Which, on their face, can feel like they are overdone and soapy, but actually are rather revelatory about the human condition. But if
and placing women's concerns in the forefront.
Yeah. Yes. And so there's a read of those films where you can be, oh, ha-ha, you know, but that's kind of the lazy read. And I mean, and I've kind of gone through this you know, cycle of it myself.
Yes.
I remember being shown Written on the Wind when I was in high school and laughing hysterically.
Yes.
And now I look at it and I realize what it is that Sirk's doing and why it matters, but I can also see what the first time viewer might find absurd about it. I would say, you know, if you're out in public, you know, maybe stay quiet at first and get a read for the room.
Always stay quiet. This is for your home. This is not for being out in the movie theater.
If you're going to see Valley of the Dolls in public, that's what it's there for.
I don't agree.
But if you're going to see Douglas Sirk in public, that's not what it's there for. Anyway.
I'm not into that.
Well, you don't like to leave the house.
I love leaving the house. I'm fixing to leave the house right now, and I'm dragging you with me.
Fine. All right. So thank you all for listening. You know what we say at the end of every episode. Go do that.
Listen to things.
Listen to things. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. It's still great. Wanted to give special thanks to Alfonso DG.
Alfonso.
Alfonso.
Not Alonso.
Not Alonso. Alfonso, who wrote a very nice 5-star review on iTunes, basically saying that he's not really listening to this for the film insight as much as he just likes to hear us converse. And so I'll take it.
Do we not provide film insight?
I hope we do. Which certainly that's the point.
Sometimes we're dumb, but
that's why we're here.
Sometimes we are. Sometimes maybe smart.
Occasionally, every so often, a little gem emerges. Anyway, but thank you for that.
I guess not.
We would love more reviews on iTunes because it just helps people on iTunes find the show. We are buried in a morass of a million different movie podcasts. So every time we get a review, it brings us a little closer to the surface. So thank you for that. And if you haven't reviewed us yet on iTunes, please do. Like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast, drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. That's also where you can PayPal us for our new Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode devoted to 2 days, 1 night. Join our Patreon club if you haven't already, and we will see you guys next time.
Goodbye.